But here we are with our guests, Robert McChesney and John Nichols.
Well, you make a good case about the problems with today's economic development and the way that technology isn't necessarily helping us, yeah. Right? Each to our own devices, but those seem to keep us a lot busier than they do help us get through the day. Mm-hmm. So in agreement generally, as we're talking about for a while, but I'm really interested in embracing the future of less jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I'd love to. We write about it a lot in the book, People Get Ready. I mean, this is something that our smartest economists have understood from the beginning of capitalism, that eventually we get to a point, because one thing capitalism does is it develops the proverbial means of production incessantly. And over 200 years, you know, it was understood that at a certain point in time, capitalism would be able to produce more than enough to satisfy all human needs, and eventually would not need a lot of people working very hard to do that. That was built into the logic of the system with development. And when we got to that point, capitalism wouldn't make very much sense as an economic system.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, its defenders would say it was really good at getting you from 0 to 60.
Yeah.
Its opponents would say it's good for 0 to 20, and then the problems intervene, your time to switch horses. Mm-hmm. But no one who thought about it much thought it could really work in a world where you're post-scarcity. The system is based on scarcity, competition, antagonism, and that becomes irrelevant and counterproductive once you're at a point where you really can easily produce more than enough that society needs. And so I think that's the point we're approaching. And
so
I think the problems that those economists foresaw are emerging front and center, which is that we have technologies that can liberate us, literally, from the drudgery of work and really change, give all people privileges once limited to a very small percentage of the human race, historically.
So what does a social movement look like? Because when I went to the Occupy protests, I was kind of surprised. People were fighting for jobs. People in that movement are fighting for jobs. And
well,
my feeling is like,
well, I think
let's fight for no jobs. And
well, you fight for jobs first.
Yeah.
You don't fight. If you want to fight for no jobs, you don't do anything. You're going to have no jobs.
Yeah.
The problem is you're going to have no jobs and you aren't going to have that post-scarcity lifestyle. You're going to be poor. I mean, that's the problem with capitalism, is that its way of doing these new technologies is that the benefits accrue to the monopoly owners of corporations.
Yeah.
And everyone else is on a life raft out in the middle of the ocean. Good luck, pal.
So
you're getting nothing.
Do the billionaires know this? Do the billionaires know that capitalism was only to get us so far?
You know, they don't. That's not their job.
They don't care?
Well, it's not that they care. They're not professors. They're not philosophers. They're businessmen. Their job is to maximize returns, period.
Yeah.
And if they're thinking about, they got their eye on some other ball, they're going to get hit in the head by the fastball coming at them.
Yeah.
They got to focus on that. Everything's built around that. And like anyone in that position, they're going to develop a worldview that comports with their privileges and their role and gets their game face on to go out and maximize their profits.
Right.
You know, they believe, I'm sure most of them, if they've given it any thought, say, well, the market will solve this. The market that made me rich, the market that made me a really big shot, people kissing my butt all day, is a great thing. It'll solve this problem for everyone else if they get off their butts and work.
And it's increasingly a belief system that the market is a moral thing in itself, that it's capable of dealing with society.
Yeah, and I think that belief system is sort of rolled up against the rocks, the rocky shore of reality.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that belief system works a lot better when you have 5% unemployment and you have a relatively strong middle class that believes it has to defend its position.
Yeah.
When you have a situation we have today where for people under 30, they're living in a Great Depression, and the way things are going 20 years from now, this will look like a golden age for people under 30. You know, then that market stuff is just so much hooey. I mean, that's just, it's irrelevant jargon. It means nothing to the reality people are facing. That's the moment we're in now. So, but I mean, going back to your point, people have a right to demand that the benefits of the wealth that society is capable of producing be shared by the people in this country. They don't accrue to a handful of private owners, monopolists. And that's where the jobs issue comes in. people have a right as long as you have to a job that pays well. Now, I think the rational solution in a democratic society is that over time say, well, maybe we don't have to work 40 or 50 hours a week. Maybe we ought to have enough of a wage and enough social services so that everyone can work 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week. You know, share the benefits and move down and still have a high quality life. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not like you and I can wake up tomorrow and suddenly everyone's living in a villa in the south of France.
Yes, and maybe that nobody gets to live in some fantastic palace.
It's a process, but the process begins with certain core principles that everyone has a right to a decent living, a right to health and education, you know, a right to have a decent life.
Yeah, and the worldview that I have, which I run up against the world all the time, is that, well, we're born into this world. We have a right to everything that's here. And the worldview of the corporations, from what I'm seeing, is you don't. Whoever decides they own it, that's who has the right to it. And forget about the fact that this planet existed before this corporation did and will after it. It does seem to be that it's all about a short-term profit, and there's no confidence whether you're a billionaire or poor. The markets are all about short-term gains, rise and falls.
I mean, the most important point, and the reason why this is going to come, in a way, the discussion we're having now is really important, absolutely central. But in a way, I think there's a tsunami of history about to hit us that's going to make this argument, or discussion even, seem orthogonal to what's going on, because we're in a situation where the global capitalist economy is pretty much dead in the water. There's not much happening. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
And the reality of this sort of jobless economy is the negative jobless economy. Mm-hmm. People are starving, or they're poor, or they're scrambling in terrible jobs with no benefits, no security. Yeah. That's going to override, that's going to be the dominant issue. Mm-hmm. And it's how we deal with that's going to be the going to tell us a lot about the future of the country and our species for this century and beyond. And our argument is that in this moment, what we need more than anything is to have people who are of the country participate in the decision-making process. These are political issues, not economic. These are all political. What sort of politics of how our society is going to be organized. And that the great crisis in the United States is not an economic crisis, not a technological crisis, as much as a political crisis. That our governing system is completely corrupt, completely run by the few for the few, and that the great bulk of Americans have no idea what's going on. They're not allowed in on these debates. And if that happens, we can be pretty sure the sort of solutions we're going to have aren't going to be very good ones for most people. Because the great line in politics, if you're not at the table when decisions are being made, you're what's being served. And that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah,
here.
It's what I have a hard time envisioning is, although I want to see this, is a much more direct participation. I like Chomsky's talked about it. You have an electorate that has an ongoing discussion in their own town or city.
Mm-hmm.
A candidate, presidential candidate, walks in. If it doesn't jive with them, or if they can offer nothing to that conversation, then we do away with them. I like that description of it, but I don't see practicality.
You know, I don't think we even have to be that precise right now.
Yeah.
I think you're almost in the weeds too quickly. I think we have a surface of 10,000 feet, get the lay of the land.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of weeds we can go into, not just that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the situation is that, you know, the key to having a democracy work is you have to have an infrastructure. That means you have to have credible media.
Democratic infrastructure.
Yeah, you've got to have that. You've got to have an education system. You can't have too much inequality. You have to have social security. You know, starving and homeless people can't participate. That's a joke.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have a variety of things put in place. And those are the battles we have to win. If we win those so that people can participate effectively, I have no doubt we'll come up with good solutions. There's lots of great ideas. There's a lot of brilliant people and talented people.
Good point.
But the point is simply we've got to get to the point where we actually have people in the game. And that's creating the democratic infrastructure. And we have a lot to learn about this from American history. We write about it in the book. The sort of right-wing narrative that America's always been sort of a capitalist oligarchy, and everyone embraced that from the beginning, and that's just, you know, our in our DNA. As soon as you get off the boat or you cross the Canadian border, it's garbage. It's just simply untenable. Yeah. It's a myth that's used to continue the recent turn towards oligarchy. Likewise, we look at this country's history compared to other democracies. We can learn a lot from other democracies, and people talk about Denmark and Sweden and Germany and Japan, these more advanced democracies. Well, you study them closely, you find out that they got a lot of what they're doing from us. They looked at Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940s. He really inspired what we call social democracy in all the countries I just named. That now we're looking to, so these guys have figured out how to let people get educated, give them health care, battle inequality, you know. So there's a rich history there we can tap on that has been largely ignored that we try to exhume in this book.
One thing, I know you got to go pretty soon.
I've got one more question.
One more question. Do you see a connection between the civil rights movement, and its passing with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the sort of power grab since then? Do you see that? The economic power grab, the political power grab, the economics have been slipping for the 90%, not really the 99%.
Well, you've opened up a huge
can of worms.
I don't think I can do justice to that in less than 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many layers to answer that accurately.
But you see that connection, though.
The only thing I would say is that I think that the sort of stagnation of the economy and the corruption of the politics has sort of made movements, traditional movements, weaker and willing to have forced them to settle for less than they would have settled for when they began and were inspired and grew, and that they've sort of exhausted themselves that way. And I think that they need to be rejuvenated. They're in the process, actually, of being rejuvenated right now so that they're connecting to the real issues facing people and they're asking big demands again instead of settling for really nothing, which is what they've been settling for 30 years, for the most part.
Okay.
I'll let John take over. Did you check out yet?
Yeah. You're asking about the civil rights movement, the impact that it had on the response of wealthy and powerful elites to an expansion of democracy. And you asked the exact right question. That's precisely
Thank
the
you.
Issue. The expansion of democracy that we saw from around 1960 until around 1975 was profoundly troublesome to political and economic elites in America. They responded to it in many, many ways. You saw some cases in southern states of actual violence to prevent African Americans and others from voting. You saw resistance to the expansion of the Voting Rights Act into certain states. But beyond that, you saw resistance to efforts to open up the political process for women, for young people, and others. But in those days, because you had tremendous movements in play, it was working. Things were opening up. Mm-hmm. And the critical turning point came in the early 1970s when Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memorandum. Lewis Powell was a lawyer for the tobacco industry and other interests. And he said, look, you know, this country is changing radically. And working class, poor people, women, people of color are really asserting their demands. Consumers are asserting their demands. Citizens are asserting their demands in all sorts of ways. And what he basically said is corporations have to do something about this. You know, we have to step up and push back. We write about this a lot in several of our books, including the current one. And what happened was you saw a genuine response to that. There's no mystery in it. It has been written about. Corporations began to focus immense amounts of money on lobbying in Washington to get control of the regulatory processes and structural influence. They began to pour money into developing their own media. They began to pour money into campaigns. They began to focus on the judiciary with an eye toward changing the law so that they could flood money into our politics. And they have been immensely successful in responding to those changes of the 60s and early 70s by making the reality of democracy, the fact that we can all vote, less significant than the reality of their money, the fact that they can both influence the public discourse, narrow it, and also influence the voting process itself with pouring money into it. And the final aspect of it that's very important here is that in this incredibly narrowed discourse that we live in, we actually have people who accept this notion that the redistribution of the wealth upward is necessary to make society work. And so you have literally the circumstance where, at the same time we're debating cutting taxes for billionaires, we're talking about cutting food stamps for the poorest people in the country.
Right.
They have won.
Yeah.
In many, many
ways. The dialogue is so favored in that way that the left is center, if not right.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about the moment we're in. The left has reasserted itself in the last 3 or 4 years in ways that it had gotten very, very weak. And you're starting to see some really interesting stuff going on. I think there's a convergence of movements, much like you saw, you know, at different times in history, that's very exciting. It's actually a very hopeful thing. You have Fight for 15 and a union, which is a very profound reality. You have a strong immigrant rights movement. You have a Black Lives Matter movement. You have a climate change movement. All these movements are bigger and stronger than mm-hmm. many of the movements we've seen throughout history. The challenge now is that they're not hooped together. They're not linked
right.
with one another.
They're so fragmented that they cannot move as one force, because they're all addressing really one essential problem, aren't they?
No, actually, no. I think they're all addressing parts of one essential problem,
yeah.
Yes. But we can't, you know, to ask people to conflate their values and their ideals to fit into a mold that you or I might say is the right place to be. What we have to recognize is that other people have a right place to be. Our job is to build a solidarity politics that has people look at their needs and their demands and see them as part of a whole. The problem in America is not so much that people are fragmented, but that we don't have unifying ideology on the left. And that's a big, big problem. What might be thought of as the left in America extends from what was the old center-right, maybe even the right,
yeah.
all the way over to socialism.
As Bernie says, Eisenhower was the last socialist.
Whereas,
president.
You know, and people look back at Eisenhower, and I actually think Eisenhower was you know, strikingly good in many areas as a president, but the problem is that, you know, he was not somebody that the left loved. You know, I mean, he was, and
right.
this is the thing, we have to remember, Franklin Roosevelt now has been turned into an iconic figure for the left, and I'm very impressed, I'm a huge fan of a lot of what Roosevelt did, but it's important to understand that Norman Thomas and others ran against Roosevelt because they said he was too conservative,
yeah.
and there were people in Congress who felt he was way too conservative.
Hmm.
So, yeah, we've skewed things so badly now that we don't have a realistic ideological dialogue in America. That makes it harder for people to fit these fragmented movements into a whole, but it's not something that's not going to happen. It will happen, and in fact, the climate challenges and the economic challenges that we face right now are going to force us to hoop together.
Yeah,
it's going to. I mean, you don't have to worry at all. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
The only question is, do we get our act together, all of us, humanity, quickly enough to intervene before multinational corporations, huge monopolies, kind of squeeze the last of it out of us. And that's it's really a race because, you know, the CEOs of big corporations, they don't worry about the future. They worry about the next quarterly statement. But they also, ultimately, they want to take advantage of the moment that we're in. What they recognize is that we, the people, are willing, you know, not all for good, you know, but generally we're willing to do a lot to try and survive, right? We're willing to work very, very hard to try and survive. And so when they take away jobs in traditional sense, the response is not to say, oh, well, you know, we should have a social welfare state and some cushion and some structures that make our lives more humane. We should perhaps develop worker-owned companies that allow us to... No, the response often is to work harder in the existing structures, but to do a gig economy, right?
Right.
To, you know, turn our private car into an Uber vehicle, to turn a room in our home into an Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, all these things to try and cobble together an existence. They know that.
Yeah.
And in fact, the amazing thing is, this is the incredible thing. The monopolies of the tech era actually can profit off our desperation, right?
No doubt.
And so it's not, in the short term, they don't see any problem with this at all. The question is, you know, where does it, what's the end game on that? The end game on that is a pretty bad one for all of us, maybe even for some of them. But we've got to intervene now. We have immediate demands to act.
Do you think that it's going to come in the worker co-op, like more cooperative management in the corporation itself, more so that the workers have more democratic influence over the corporation? Do you think that's the most important thing? Do you think it's better maybe eliminating the money from politics, the dollarocracy?
It's very easy. Yeah, look, the first step is to get small d democratic control over our politics and our economy, right? Mm-hmm. You have to make the small d democratic changes that allow us to have real power. Then as we start to arrange things, yeah, we can organize in all sorts of different ways. But this is an old story. You know, the Luddites, 200 years ago, as they fought against the change from an agrarian society to an industrial revolution moment, they saw the problems that were coming their way. They saw that their lives would be made, you know, much more horrible. And they fought against it. They were beaten. And then they were, you know, kind of held down for many years. But as they were held down, they began to look more seriously. You know, how do we tackle these changes that are going to affect everything in our lives? They ultimately became radical activists for democracy. They started talking about full suffrage. Everybody gets to vote. They started talking about real elections, you know, a politics that actually gives power to people. And you know what the interesting thing about it was? It worked. They actually did assert a popular power. They eventually got voting rights for women. They saw the rise of the trade union movement. You saw the rise of a social welfare state. You really did begin to tame the worst excesses of the Industrial Revolution. And they did it by getting small d democratic power. Now, I want to emphasize, though, this is not just electoral power. It's not just winning elections. This is the idea that, just a simple concept, when a problem presents itself, do the people think that they can, you know, listen to a lot of different ideas, settle on a good idea, and make it so? If that's the case, then they have small d democratic power. If that is not the case, then they don't. And all I can tell you is that the answer to any problem is to make people feel confident. The great mass of people feel confident that when a problem comes their way, they can you know, sort through the solutions and you know, put something forward. Right now, that power rests in the CEOs of large monopolies, multinational corporations. They see a problem come toward them, they look at their options and they act. We need to shift that power balance. And then how you respond, you know, if we free up space for people to have their own businesses, you know, worker owned cooperatives and all sorts of things like that, that's fine. If people want to work less and yield the, you know, take the benefits of a technological progress and just make their lives easier, you know, that's also a huge part of this. Certainly, there's an argument for a social welfare state that underpins, especially in the immediate sense, a gig economy, so that if you're out there cobbling things together, you're trying to find the money to pay for a little bit of health care.
Right, and you don't have access to unemployment when you lose your gigs.
Right. I know, it's just the whole thing starts to fall apart there. So, I mean, the way to understand this is that there are many steps up the ladder, right? First step is to get power, give it to the people, right? How do we do that? Yeah, money out of politics and address. The biggest thing, we could go through like a million fixes, right? Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is best expressed by Zephyr Teachout, who we write about in the book. She says we just got to end corruption. You know, no, I'm not kidding. Yeah. I mean, we have a staggeringly corrupted
legally defined. I mean, it's legally, it's been made acceptable.
You know,
to where what's in this American society now, what's legal is what's moral. So it's a morally accepted form of corruption.
If your grandparents came along right now, great grandparents, and they looked at this,
aren't they voting for Trump though?
No, they're not. Well, they may be. Let's say somebody from 100 years ago.
Okay.
They would say this is an unimaginable corruption. Right? They would also say that nothing of the last century had occurred. They would literally say, oh, I guess we didn't have the Progressive Movement and New Deal or things like that, that, and everything that sort of asserted the power of the people, because we've ended up back pretty much on the cusp of Gilded Age. Our trade unions are down to, you know, incredibly low levels of membership, terribly low levels of membership. Voter participation is way down from where it once was. Engagement in all sorts of areas has been really beaten back. We have a handful of multinational corporations that are immensely powerful. We have monopolies now that control, you know, kind of whole industries, you know, look at communications especially.
Every time I turn around, there's another merger
of
enormous companies.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's sort of like, oh, well, so I guess the trust busters and the progressive reforms and all these things, you know.
It's reversed.
Yeah.
But there's this facade. I mean, as long as we, like, I think a lot of us felt pretty comfortable when we saw Obama elected.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I was an activist during the Bush era. Obama's elected. I kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
And then in the last 4 years, I've just been like, on it. And I'm like, whoa, what the heck?
Yeah, and you see...
And you know, the thing is, it's not... You did talk about this on the radio, and I'm sure in the book, the Republican Party's falling apart, Democratic... it's all... So, is there an end to the party system at all?
Well, we can hope so, but that's not going to come quickly. I mean, look, the once we start to free things up, to try and address the core corruption of the thing, and just say, okay, let's try and at least clean it up so we can start to make some decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's the bottom line on corruption. When it's so overwhelming, many people just step away and they say, this is so awful. Or they go to, you know, they find the most extreme response and hope that that somehow, you know, that maybe Donald Trump will fix it, right? But at the end of the day, what we have to do is recognize that there is scorching corruption. We have to address it. Once we do, and then get the money out, address the lobbying, address the revolving door politics, all these things, you know, we can just list hundreds of things. Gerrymandering of districts, the existence of an electoral college that where you could put somebody who lost a popular vote in the presidency, all these things. Once we address that, then we start to think about, okay, well, what's a system that actually functions? You know, I mean, I would argue that there's something pretty absurd about a system where we elect a president in 2008, and then in 2010 we elected Congress to fully disempower him, right?
Yeah.
Then we re-elect the president in 2012, and then we,
The we that we're talking about? Because it was like a 20 to 30% drop
it's not the same
in
people.
Voter turnout.
No, what happens is the Democrats show up for presidential elections, they don't show up for non-presidential,
right.
But even if you're beyond that, you have a system that was created, you realize that the rough outlines of our electoral and structures, a lot of them were created at a time when, you know, people got places in horse and buggies. We allowed people to hold slaves, and we treated diseases by bleeding ourselves, right?
Right.
So maybe we ought to think about whether the basic structures are the right structures for the 21st century.
Because it seems like we have all these social medias, we have all these platforms that are bringing us, bringing us together. It's not hooping us together, as you put it. Or you gotta go. But it is bringing us together onto a platform, namely Facebook. But we don't use that opportunity to be together, to share, to learn from one another so much. What I see is an increasing division built on propaganda, which is memes. Mm-hmm. That's just voluntary propaganda stuff.
Well, so much.
And look.
Here's what you're doing here is really vital. You're sitting down with people, you're asking them some questions, starting conversations. That's the heart of it. You know, I can't emphasize. The most important thing that we can do is start talking to one another. Literally. Stop taking information in, you know, just as a, you know, something thrown at us and we let it pile up on us. We need to have conversations. Those conversations are the points at which we raise our own thinking to a higher level. And ultimately, we might just get to a place, maybe, where we find that there's much more commonality, much more agreement than we think. But we can't get there unless we recognize that all the volatility and all the trauma of this moment is rooted in a set of challenges that go back to our lack of power, right? We don't have the ability to respond quickly and well as the people to broad challenges. We've got to get that ability, and I do have to go.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for sitting with me. And thank you for sitting with me and for sitting through another Horizon at End Times podcast. I do appreciate it. I got more episodes coming I'm excited about. We'll see you soon. More music from Kasim Nakhvi. Still the same tune, Preamble. From the album of the same title. Through next time, be happy.